Yeah, I'm close there, guys. Hi, everyone. My name's Bernard. I'm an alcoholic. We're running a bit late, so we've got an extra speaker now. We were only having one, but now we've got two. We've got Annie from, well, I've been told Annie from Ireland. Now she's Annie from London. So, all right, Annie. Are you okay, yeah?
Yeah, I'm good.
Good. Right, you've got about a good 45 minutes if you want it, yeah?
God.
Yeah, no, there's no pressure. Right, and
Bernie, don't forget the radio.
It's on.
Oh.
Yeah, and I don't want to go. So you're right to go, yeah?
Yeah.
All right. So when was your first meeting?
On the 3rd of January 1980.
Well, you're still doing 1990 then?
Yeah.
No. You want to roll or do you want to...
Just go.
All right, no worries then.
Okay, my name's Annie. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
I am Annie.
I say grateful to try and remind myself to be grateful because I forget to be grateful and I forget to make the gratitude list. Like in the early days, you'd phone up your sponsor and they'd say, write down five things that you're grateful for, and you couldn't think of one. Now I'm grateful that I wake up in the morning. I'm grateful I wake up in the bed I'm supposed to wake up in the morning. I'm very grateful Quasimodo's not next to me. That genuinely happened, I'll tell you. Genuinely, it was Quasimodo. And then Hannibal Lecter, and that was dreadful, embarrassing, actually. And I was, thinking of waking up. I used to wake up in the back of cabs in Epping Forest and forget where I lived. At the time, I lived in Hertfordshire. I had a manor house. I left Ireland at the age of 14. I'll just give you a quick. I came from an alcoholic family. I was the seventh child. My mum died with a wet brain in a hospital called Grange Gorman, which is a mental hospital in Dublin. My three brothers committed suicide, and all the family, all direct alcoholic related deaths. The suicides were all while they were drunk. They called it while the balance of the mind was disturbed. I was 14 when the first one happened. So then I left Dublin and I arrived at Euston Station on a child's ticket that cost £1. It was 30 shillings in those days. Cost £1.50. And I suppose Irish luck was with me. You know, I ended up going to sleep with nuns up in North London, and I met a girl there who was with her cousin. She was 30, he was 17, and there was a bit of incest going on or something. They'd left Ireland together. So the three of us walked into Camden Town and we got a room in Arlington Road for £1 each. And I went to work in Lyons Corner House, which is better than McDonald's, pouring the teas and coffees. And then I went to work in a hospital. We pretended we were 18, of course, and they made me waitress for the nurses and doctors. So they used to dress me up in a little waitress outfit, and it was very nice, actually. I learned how to put knives and forks on the table, silvers and all that stuff, and that was good. And then my friend and I, we decided we'd go to Jersey. They used to do holidays for... They used to do holidays for where you could get lots of money as tips. And we went up to Old Compton Street where the agency was, and it was shut when we got there at lunchtime. So we went into that pub on the corner of Old Compton Street. I was up there yesterday, and every time I go by it, the memories. And this little man in a red carnation came over, and he was buying us gins and tonics. And he started asking what we were doing. And we said, well, we were going to work in Jersey as waitresses for the season. And he said, I've got a club down the road. Come and have a look. So we went into the merry-go-round, St. James's, which I don't know if anybody remembers. And that was a very, very plush club. It was, you know, velvet wallpaper, very, very, very upmarket. And in those days, the clubs had to have licenses from 3 to 11. And all the old colonels from White's and the other men's clubs used to come in. And one of them bought me a gold bracelet. And I started collecting charms. And all these old colonels used to come in. And I had a gold sovereign collection in no time. And they were all very nice to us. And the train robbers used to come in to bet on their horses in the room next door because they had a tic-tac machine. So the train robbers took a liking to myself and my friend because we're only 15. And now when I look back on it, you know, it's probably because we were two 15-year-olds and they had flashy cars and they liked flashing us around too. So they used to take us to nightclubs and buy us dresses and take us out in their sports cars, and they kept giving us money. And when we would go to parties at their houses, they all had... This was before the train robbery. They had nice houses anyway. They were doing well, you know. They all had Jags and, you know, all that. And anytime anyone would try to take advantage of us, they would say, you know, behave yourself, leave. They were like our protectors, you know. I remained a virgin till I was 19, so, you know, I must have been safe. And then at 19, I met my first boyfriend called Alan. He was a guards. He was one of the guards, Buckingham Palace. And he was 6'2" and very hunky. And we got engaged. I got my first engagement ring. First engagement ring. we got it in Lindsay's in Westbourne Grove. And it was 3 carats, but it had a flaw. We got a good deal. But it was a good flash. And we lived together for 2 years. And he was a professional gambler. And it cured me of gambling because my jewellery was in the palm 1 week, out the next week. It was madness. I hated it. And we used to spend a fortune on taxis, and he wouldn't buy a car till he had the money for a Bentley. We, you know, very, we wanted the best. So then he slept with a stripper. So I left him. Because, you know, nice Irish Catholic girl had been brought up, you only sleep with the person you're going to marry. And he slept with his stripper and spoiled it all. So then one of the guys who used to come into the club where the showbiz club by now in Wardour Street, where all the show business people used to come, like Shirley Bassey and Kenny Lynch and the people of those days, and all the theatre people used to come. And they all used to bring me presents and clothes, and they were all really nice. And anyway, I've forgotten where I'm going now. What was I talking about?
You're trusting me. It was on about, you were a good girl till you were 19.
Yeah, so then I'm... That about sums it. Yeah. And then I met there was a boxer called Billy Walker in those days who was the blue-eyed bombshell, and his brother, who was also training to be a boxer but got a hit in the eye and couldn't do it, but became Billy and George. They were like Billy's manager. So he was like the David Beckham of the 60s, and the family, although they were from the East End market, they were making tons of money because they opened the baked potato places and all of that sort of thing. And I would tell him about, I came from this horrible Irish drunken family. I could never bring anyone to my house because everyone was drunk. And I always dreamed of having a lovely house that, you know, I could invite friends for dinner and things. So he bought me this lovely manor house down in Hertfordshire, and he put it in my name. And so it went on to become that there was a guy who used to make nice dresses called Ozzy Clark, and he used to come down. They used to call it Annie's Health Farm in the country. and he used to come down for the weekend. So I would get all these lovely Aussie Clark dresses with, you know, one leg hanging out, one arm hanging out. And we went to a party at the Pink Floyd's house, and that was my first contact with the police. They started searching us all for drugs as we were leaving at 6 a.m, and they started manhandling one of my musician friends. So I decided to give the policeman a good kicking, and it ended up in court. And I didn't want to not guilty because I think I thought I was somebody, and I wouldn't get a visa to America if I had a conviction. So I got embarrassed. I should have just walked in and said guilty and paid £2 fine for being drunk D&D. But instead I had to get a barrister from London, give him a grand to get me a not proven. And so I got away with that. Then the next thing was, you know, drunk and driving. It goes on and, you know, the downward spiral starts. And then I broke up with him. Again, he slept with one of my friends. The next one, after being with him for 7 years. You know, I keep choosing the wrong men, or, you know. So I left him, walked away from the manor house and the other, or everything, and the cars, and thought that was terrible what he did. And I went off to the south of France for a year and fell in love with the French drummer with the band and went on a tour of France. And it was great, what I can remember. I spent a year in Paris. But he was a Hungarian, you know, refugee who lived in France all his life. And I think of him as the love of my life. But what happened, I turned up unexpectedly in Paris. We spent a year together. And I turned up, and he had a girl in bed. Again, this is third one. So I smashed the flat up, smashed his drum kit up, and went berserk. And of course, he never wanted to speak to me again. And I'm sorry to this day I did that, because he was really the best thing I've ever met. But anyway, so it went on. Then I married the best-looking guy on the King's Road. and he married me because I had, you know, money and houses, because I'd acquired them all from the ex-boyfriend. And then my daughter was born, and he was a real nutter. He'd become a Jehovah's Witness. And when my daughter was a cesarean, he said I couldn't have it that we were Jehovah's Witnesses. And I said, I'm not, I'm an Irish Catholic, you know. And so then when my daughter was 10 months old, I got a German au pair, and we went out to Barbados just to get away, because this husband was chasing me all around and threatening to kill me. He actually did end up at the Old Bailey on an attempted murder charge. He kidnapped our daughter, and there was big dramas going down. It was horrible. But so I went out to Barbados to hide from him. And then I met some Canadian airline pilots who were bringing cocaine through. And we used to meet them at the airport. I was hanging out with an old pirate called Captain George. And he used to meet them at the airport, and he liked my German au pair because she looked like Marilyn Monroe. And we used to meet these pilots at the airport, and they got out the coke, and they were all sniffing it. And in London, I'd walked out of parties when people did that. You know, I thought, that's drugs. I didn't even want to smoke weed. You know, that was for idiots. But I had my first line of coke, and that lasted from 1974 until the 3rd of January 1980, when I lost all the houses, spent everything, lost all the jewelry. They used to say I had more jewelry than Liz Taylor. And everything gone. And I ended up I married a punk rocker who had no money, no deal. And he was 15 years younger than me. And we had my daughter, Natasha. So I've got Joanne and Natasha now. And Joanne's 4 years older and Natasha's 7 months old. And we went out to dinner on New Year's Eve with my Jewish mother-in-law, and she didn't like me. She said she only had the Irish people in the house to do the cleaning. And plus I was older than her son, so it was all not right in her. And she had her Greek 24-year-old boyfriend with her, so I don't know what she was on about. She was she was 16. She had a Greek, you know, fisherman boyfriend. But anyway, it ended up that I don't know what happened after the party, but on the 3rd of January, I woke up in the morning, and we lived in a mansion block off the river in Chelsea, and I came to, because we don't wake up when we're drinking, we come to, don't we? So I came to, and I turned, and my husband's face was like scratched to hell, and he looked like he'd been in an accident or something. So I thought, what's happened? And I ran to the bathroom, and I looked in, and I saw Natasha, who was 7 months, the baby. And then I looked in my daughter's room and checked them. Then I looked in the living room, Christmas tree knocked over like World War III had happened. Then I go to the kitchen, and we had this fancy Welsh dresser with really nice china, and it was all smashed. And I went back in, and I woke up and to my husband and said, what happened? He said, you did it. And I did all that on a blackout. I don't know, you know, if he hadn't, I must have done it. And it was on a total blackout. And there was no violence. He was the most gentle, sweetest person you could imagine. You know, he didn't have a... So I don't know what happened. I just went nuts. But then I came from a family where my mother used to bash us all up all the time when she was drunk. So it was probably a bit of the madness, you know, that I did that. So somehow Mari from the office in Redcliffe Gardens and Trevor, they're both now dead, I went to both their funerals, they turned up on my door and they said, we're taking you to an AA meeting. So I went to Kensington High Street meeting on a Sunday night, and there were all these people sitting looking like you lot are, you know, looking respectable, nicely dressed, and there was a woman at the front. She's still around, and she was sharing how she'd been in Holloway. And I immediately thought, oh, this is for, you know, this is for criminals and people like that. You know, I don't identify with any of this. And then there was people at the meeting saying, oh, I had the Sheikhs waiting for the off-license to open. And I was shouting, phone your coke dealer. And I disrupted the whole meeting, and an Irish man at the back said, can that girl stop talking about drugs? This is for people with a drink problem. So I walked out, and Andre came after me. Andre was an Irishman who died 27 years sober. He had a lot of Dobermans he lived in Pimlico, and he came after me, and he held my hand, and he took my number. And I think he was saying, get to bed tonight without a drink, can you do that? And I told him, no, you know, my husband's a musician, we never go to bed without a drink. Anyway, he got us along to Al-Anon on the Friday. It had just started, I think, because we're talking 1980. And the Al-Anon was in Marylebone High Street in a church. And he steered me into one room, and they were all sitting around, and there were holy Catholic pictures on the wall. And I didn't believe in God because all the suicides in my family, you know, I'd lost it with God. And the nuns had given me a hard time at school as well, so I didn't want to know about any of the God stuff. And he stirred my husband into the next room, which was the Al-Anon meeting. And then I think it had just started because there was only two women in their 60s there. And he walked in, and he was a 22-year-old punk with his hair all orange and, you know, punk clothes. And he went and sat with them, and I sat in the meeting. And when we walked out and met after the meeting, he just looked at me and he said, what do you think? And I said, I don't know. And he said, let's get the fuck out of here. And he said, he said, so we went down to the Speakeasy nightclub. And then I thought, I don't want to go and sit. I'm not an alcoholic. How dare they? You know, that's a terrible thing to call someone. And now today, I know what an alcoholic is. I'm very happy to be an alcoholic. If I was given a list of illnesses and someone said, choose an illness, I would, alcoholism is the best one to have, because the benefits of the cure is fantastic. You know, you get to meet all these lovely people, and I mean, my best friends are in the fellowship now. I've had friends of more than 30 years that are still my friends today, and we don't fall out, and we support one another, and we go on holidays and things, and it's the best thing to be an alcoholic. It really is, for me anyway. You know, if you were to ask me, write a list of how you'd like your life to be as you get older, I couldn't have a better life than I have, really, because, you know, I've been to every country. I've been to Japan, Hawaii. I go to the States all the time. I've been to most of the islands on the Caribbean. You know, life is good. And but of course, there's always the roller coaster where, you know, parts of it are not good. My 17-year-old daughter was a great horse rider. She won everything she entered at shows. And I've got all her trophies at home. And at 17, she had a horse accident, and she got killed. She died. And I thought getting bankrupt and losing my house was the worst thing that could happen to a human being. But then when Natasha died, that's the worst thing that can happen. And I've just been by her grave, actually. She's buried up by Windsor. And I better go back and clean it up. It looks very neglected. And then my Natasha went to Ibstock School and had the best education that money could buy. And she died, and that was really sad. And she was very talented also, not because she's dead, but she was. And my other daughter, Joanne, also went to Morehouse and Collingham. If anyone knows central London schools, they're considered the tops. And she moved in with a drug dealer at the age of 16 and took ecstasy for 5 years. She went to a party, a rave, the raves were going, and a guy said to her, the MC said, if you want to have a good time, take this, and he gave her an ecstasy tablet. And she became addicted to them and couldn't stop using them for 5 years. And kept using them and wrecked herself. You know, she's still not right. She says she's bipolar, you know, stuff like that. It's really sad. And that's a hard pill to swallow. You know, you bring your daughter up to be a princess, and she's brought up on the 12-step program and knows to give people, when anyone rings the house, tell them where the meeting is. And then she... That's really hard, but she had she picked up with one of the people she was using with from Liverpool, and she had Jasmine, who's going to be 18 in September, and she's been a great mum. She doesn't drink or use anymore. She's the best mother. My granddaughter is extremely bright. She's a published author. She was picked as, you know, writing the best book in her school. And she's hoping to get into St. Andrews University. And she's very nice. You know, she's 5'11" and she's not even 18 yet. And she's lovely. So that's a blessing. And, you know, I've learned how to deal with the worst things that can happen. You know, bankruptcy, losing your home, ending up... Imagine being homeless 10 years sober and you think, I've been working my guts out for a home, you know. But I continue to work my guts out, and now I've got a night... You know, I've got a roof in my head and food in the cupboard. So that's all we're supposed to want from the fellowship. You know, we didn't come into the fellowship saying, well, if I win the lottery, I'll stay sober. Would be nice, though. But you know, when I first ended up in AA, I thought it was the end of my life. I thought it was the end of the world. I thought, but now, you know, in hindsight, it was the best thing that could have happened to me. You know, because my life is great, and I've got my senses today. You know, where I came from and all my family came from, and where they're all dead now. I'm the only survivor of the family. And so I've been blessed. I've been blessed. And the person who helped me most and saved me from jail when I got a 2-year sentence for driving while disqualified, and I drove again when I got drunk. And Paddy O.C., he died in 84. And he told me, when I would ring him up and say, oh, I'm feeling weird and I'm depressed and I'm feeling terrible. And one time I managed to get this old Victorian house in Chelsea, and the bathroom was above the living room, and it had a lovely ceiling with, you know, old-fashioned things on. And I got home and the ceiling had fallen in, so I rang up Paddy and I said, Paddy, the ceiling's fallen in. And he said, that don't matter, so long as your head don't fall in, you'll be all right. So we got that fixed. And then when I would phone him up whinging, he would say, have you been to a meeting to talk to a newcomer? Get to a meeting and talk to a newcomer and phone me back after. That was his remedy. Go and do service. His life was service. He was the nearest thing I met to Francis of Assisi on this earth, you know. I had the privilege of holding his hand when he died. I was with him in St. Mary's when he died. And what he said, his last breaths were, he had Paddy Walsh, this sponsee, or I don't know who was whose sponsor, in Galway. And he said to me, phone Paddy Walsh and tell him that Mick the Tig, who had died a year previously, has asked me to do the chair tonight. And with that, he died. And, you know, I was holding his hand, and I remember going home, and I brought him salt beef sandwiches from Selfridges because he really liked those. And I could smell the salt beef because we'd been eating the salt beef sandwich. And my daughter was with me, Joanne, and I sent her home because I knew I couldn't leave him. I just felt I couldn't leave him because he was breathing funny and stuff. And when I went home that night, I was drained and exhausted because I had to deal with all his family coming in. They were fighting over his gold rings and trinkets. It's terrible when people die. They want... Paddy Walsh asked me to get his AA ring, but his family had taken it, and Paddy offered to buy it and they wouldn't give it to us, and there was terrible stuff. But when I got home that night, and I just go to bed and I'm totally exhausted, and at the time I was living in Chelsea, and I was this artist studio room with a big high ceiling, and I could smell the salt beef sandwich, and I'm thinking of Paddy. And, you know, this sounds mad, but I swear to God, he came to the end of the bed, like he used to always say to me, and said, it'll be all right. It'll be all right, with his nice Irish accent. And now I still hear his voice when the fertilizer hits the fan. I hear Paddy's voice saying, I hear him saying, it'll be all right, you know, and everything is all right. And I'm just blessed to be here. And, you know, I could tell you loads of silly stories. Oh, there's one thing that I'm really impressed with. I did one of these psychology of vision courses, you know, where you go to Hawaii and you go to Tokyo in Japan and you do a psychology with the Japanese masters, and you think you're going to be very clever, you know, and you get the certificate and all of that. And I went trying to solve the problems of why my daughter was the way she was, and to help newcomers, you know. I've done all these counselor things, but I've never used them because, you know, I got what I got for free, so I keep what I've got by giving it away, not selling it, you know. So I did it to be more clever with newcomers more than anything. But this workshop was called The Golden Life, and there was about 80 people, and there was a Japanese sumi wrestler, there was all sort of a mix of people. And at the end of it, after the 10-hour-a-day workshop, they went around the room and they were asking somebody something. And they came to me and they said, you appear to have acquired the Golden Life, because it was called the Golden Life, the workshop. And they said, how did you do it? And I said, well, I did 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, I got a sponsor and I do service. And then after that, there were so many people coming telling me, oh yeah, I'm an AA too. And you know, all these upmarket people were coming, and AA is great in Japan actually. They've got English speaker meetings. It's even better in Barbados. AAs, they're really serious out there. They are so serious out there. It's everything, you know. You know the labels? I've got my friend Yvonne is somewhere. I think she's here if she hasn't run out after hearing me. But my friend of 30 years from Barbados, she was speaker at a meeting and she started telling everyone, read the labels, anything with alcohol, don't risk it, you know, don't risk it. And anything in the cooking. And she started saying something which was really interesting. You know gripe water, what you give to babies? Well, apparently one of them has got alcohol in. And that's what shuts them up. So apparently that's bad, because we're giving them, it's like the old, in Ireland it was the bottle of whiskey. But the gripe water, it's not good to give to babies. You know, maybe it'll give them the flavour. And I think I've rambled on enough. How long have I got? Have I got to tell more stories?
About 10 minutes.
Okay, so
what? No, you're right. You're
I can think of some.
It was tough about your daughter, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was really sad. That was that was the hardest thing when Natasha died, and I had a house down at Windsor at the time, and I was sitting out in the garden with my other daughter, who I was nursing because she'd made 6 suicide attempts. She'd been in the Priory, she'd been in mental hospitals, and what she would do, I would leave her in the Priory or Charter or any of the places, and I would think I'm safe now. And what? And then I would drive out to, I would drive to Newmarket to visit Natasha and thinking she's safe, she's in a hospital, she's been looked after. But what she would do, she would walk out of the hospital and go and buy enough tablets to kill an elephant. And, you know, I'd been with her while the stomach pumps were being done. I found her when she slashed her wrist. She was dead in my arms when the paramedics came, you know. Brian Wells, the shrink at the Priory, who I saw a couple of weeks ago, he said, I don't think she's schizophrenic, you know, but all the ecstasy has really mashed her up bad, you know. I mean, she appears normal and she looks very presentable, but, you know, she rejects me. And when I took her to Tobago for a holiday, and she's, I don't have to sit next to you on the plane, do I? And can you make sure we've got not just separate rooms, but she wants to be at the other end of the hotel. She doesn't want me. And I'm paying for her. And I took her to Antigua, and she spoiled Christmas. You know, she was all the time something, you know. So I'm not taking her on any more holidays, because she just messes the holiday up for me. You know what, I don't know anyone who's got children, detach with love. They've got to go and make their own mistakes. We can't do it for them, you know. I mean, I would lie down and die for her to make her all right, but you know, she's got to get all right herself. But it's taken a long time. She's been like this since she was 16, you know, and of course I blame myself for it all. It's all my fault, because the first 6 years of her life I was drinking and using drugs, and you know, so I think it's all my fault. But I did hear at a meeting once that God did not save me from drowning to flog me to death on the beach. So I mustn't beat myself up, because I hear addicts in the room, addicts and alcoholics, they like a bit of self-flagellation, you know, they like beating the... We did it wrong, you know, here we go. Why do I keep doing it? Why do I do the things that I do? I used to go to a retired bishop who was... I used to go for healing. He was retired in a convent, and he said to me that he read St. Peter saying, why do I do the things I do? I don't know why I do them, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, well, even the saints did things and they didn't know, you know, what they were doing. And he told me about cry, because tears are healing. Cry, you know, it loosens the soil and the flowers grow again, you know, but I really can't cry. I've got something wrong with me. I think my mother used to say when I was a child, your blood is near your eye. and that put me off crying. I wish I could, because they say you feel better after a good cry, and men should cry, and we should all have a good cry now. but you know, thanks to this 12-step program, life is good. Life is good. And you know, my other nieces and nephews in Ireland, this story goes on. Two of my nephews in the past 4 years, the 19-year-old was taking lots of drugs, and his 16-year-old sister came home from school, walked up the stairs and found he hung himself and he was dead. And then his 27-year-old brother got in trouble again, drugs and alcohol, and he went and hung himself in front of the neighborhood out in the green, you know, and his 12-year-old daughter. And so the family continues, you know, the illness is still there. I'm the one who's got a reprieve, and I got to remember it's only a daily reprieve, you know. I'm only an arm's length away from a drink. I mean, when we turned up here today and I saw, it can't be here, this is a pub. You know? And I honestly, when I first gave up drinking, if I ever went in a pub, or my husband, a musician, to a gig where there was alcohol backstage everywhere, you know, and I would go to a meeting and I'm not going to drink in my head, you know, and I would say, if you put a gun at my head, I'm not going to have a drink. But what would happen is my hand would fly out like it was in my hand and pick up the drink. So I have a fear, even today, of being in a pub, just in case my hand flies out and picks up a drink. I don't trust, you know, I avoid it. I avoid drinking people and drinking situations like the plague. I do a runner when my favorite wine turns up, you know. Because to me, that's all bottles of vomit anyway. You know, nice bottle of chilled Chablis or Dom Perignon, what would you like? It's bottles of vomit. That's all it is. So I, Remy vomit or... But, you know, I still think of Paddy O'Shea today, because he saved me from jail. He came to court and he told the judge's story with Max Glatt, and they got me out of going to doing the jail sentence. And whenever a robin turns up, you know the Catholics say a robin is a sign the Sacred Heart of Jesus is near, and it's a good thing if you see a robin. Well, robins come in my garden quite a lot. And I think that's Paddy O'Shea, because the Christmas card he sent me just before he died on the 9th of January, the Christmas card had a big robin on it. So when I see a robin, I think, oh, you know, Paddy's... And I can hear his voice saying, it'll be all right. It'll be all right. And it is all right. And someone was telling me the other day that out of the alcoholics who make it, it's such a small percentage. There's a very... I've forgotten what the percentage is because I'm not good on figures. But apparently very few make it and, you know, stay continuously sober. So we're blessed and we're the chosen few. I wear my Star of David because it's a lucky star. I'm not Jewish. I'm on this spiritual program that has nothing to do with religion. It's the 12-step program of AA. It's nothing, you know, it's the God of our understanding. And thank you for listening. I wish I'd sort of, I don't know, I'm really bad at these chairs. I avoid them like the plague. The plan was to get Yvonne to do the chair because she does a fantastic job. Yeah, so she's still here.
No, we're overrunning. Is that you done, Annie?
Yes, thank
you.
Thank you for asking me.
It's very nice to hear, you know. It's very sad and not all of us, and it's mixed in with the fun and the heartache. And especially the bit you said about your daughter, you know, and they know how to answer the phone, and then, you know, and they brought up, you can't protect them, can you?
No.
And that's a tough one, isn't it, you know? So, right, well, we've got one more speaker. Are you right to leave the top table, please? I said please, didn't I? Well, bring a chair up, Caroline. I'm not arguing with anyone. I'm too tired. Yeah, please bring a chair up.